All right, I'm going to turn the program over to Nikki Civitini, who has been a member of our fellowship for about a year, and a very active member, which we very much appreciate, and she teaches sociology at WSU.
Thank you. That's one of my favorite books. So I'm here today to talk about a more perhaps simplistic definition of beauty. I think if you ask most adults what is beauty, they'll have something really interesting to tell you. Perhaps we'll see some examples of that in 2 weeks if people send me things, such as music or art or something like body art or a very well-prepared dish or something of that sort. I think if you ask a child, what's beauty? They'll say, my Aunt Jane or my mom, or they'll think of more of a physical beauty in terms of attractiveness. So I didn't want to have us just kind of neglect that definition of beauty and to talk a bit about it, perhaps in maybe a sort of critical way. But that's where I got this idea from. So when you think about socialization of children, we think about how they learn to become a good member of society. And the truth is, socialization is not just for children. It happens to all of us all of the time. Society is always telling us how to be a good member. It tells us when we're not being a good member, tries to get us back into line. So it's not just for kids. When we think about where that socialization, that information comes from, we can think of main social institutions. So we get that from our families, especially at a young age. Even as an adult, however, you probably still get feedback from your families about whether you're on the right path or the wrong path, some ways that you might want to change your path, etc. We get it from religion, certainly education. As young people, our peers, I think it's by about age 10, become more important in socialization than family for quite a long stretch there. Our teachers, of course, in the education institution, and then also the media. And I put a comma there if anyone wanted to share any others that we could add to that list. Right, so the economic institutions, employment, locations of employment, absolutely. We might get formal training, but we also get that informal socialization. Right, your coworkers tell you if you're on the right track, if maybe you're working a bit too hard or not hard enough. Get little hints like that.
Peers and friends.
Our peers and friends, right? Which we might meet through some of these other locations, or we might just meet in the community or by happenstance.
And the government through what law, what
mm-hmm. Right, so even things like civil rights laws certainly changed minds before they changed hearts. So the government can tell us what is acceptable and what's not, and eventually people come to accept it or not accept it. When we take this back to physical beauty and attractiveness, we can see that it's really the product of both socialization and biology. Our presenter last week talked about that scientific magic number for proportions that make things beautiful. And I kind of whispered, I think I remember it's 0.7 from my psychology courses. And my engineer partner here corrected me. He said, technically, it's the square root of 2, which is 0.707. So that's exactly what it is. But in fact, we find that to be true in terms of physical attractiveness as well, that there have been studies where they compare women with different hourglass-type figures, and the appropriate, the most attractive ratio of waist to hips is 0.7. So the waist is 0.7, the size of the hips. So we see it even in physical beauty, and we can see that there's probably a biological basis for that. Certainly some things we find attractive would have been functional in terms of human evolution. But a lot of it comes from socialization. Socialization can exaggerate those biological predispositions. It can counter them, even to the point where an unhealthy proportion becomes attractive. And we also see gender differences in this socialization. For women, we're socialized that youth is beautiful. To be younger is to be more beautiful. We also know that youth is associated with helplessness and dependence. And so eventually we make that connection in society that women who are helpless and dependent are seen to be more beautiful. And children get this message very strongly, which we'll see shortly. For men, however, maturity and virility, strength, are associated with attractiveness. And so men are taught that being efficacious, being independent, is attractive and good. And of course, boys learn this at a very young age. And there certainly may be some sexual dimorphism to this. Men, on average, are stronger than women. No one, you know, would deny that. And so we would suspect that evolution would have provided some inherent desire to see a stronger man and a less strong woman. But those have become extremely exaggerated, especially in media images, and especially those directed at children. Even when we look at famous actors and actresses and singers, we see that sexual dimorphism exaggerated in those adults. But when we look at children's cartoons, it's even more exaggerated. So how pervasive is this, and how strict are these gendered categories and the traits that we associate with each gender? Well, what's the characteristic of a princess? Okay. I just heard an NPR show last week, they were interviewing the author of a book called Cinderella Ate My Daughter, which I'm really excited to order. I haven't gotten it yet. But this girly girl culture, which really didn't exist even 15 or 20 years ago, is so strong. Right? And so what are the characteristics of a princess? You can see she's clearly very, very thin. She's beautiful. Her hair and makeup are always perfect. If her skin's a little bit dark, we hide her behind the other ones. And, of course, her head is always tilted down. In the animal kingdom, what does that mean? Submissiveness. A good, beautiful woman is always submitting herself. Eventually, the princesses get a little bit snarky. You know, we've got Megara there from Hercules. They get a little bit of attitude, but they still have to be very classically feminine, at least in appearance. And they usually take feminine roles and eventually submit to the man in the movie. And this is changed. We can see original Snow White there compared with today's Snow White. And we see a 40% increase in the size of Snow White's eyes. What does that have to do with our topic today? Well, our eyes never grow from the time we're born to the time we die. But our heads, of course, start very small. So in a baby, the eyes are a much larger proportion of the head. The larger the eyes, the younger the person looks. The chin also grows continuously throughout the life. So the smaller the chin, the younger the person. And you can see that she has a very small chin and very large eyes. She looks infantile. If we compare Rapunzel, who is the most recent princess on the right there, her eyes are 210% larger as a proportion of her face compared to original Snow White. And the eye width increased by 155%. So we're basically infantilizing the female characters that our children see. We can see the opposite trend with men. We can see that Snow White's Prince Charming on the left here has a relatively normal-looking face. If we look down at the bottom at in Pocahontas, I think that's, is that Cook?
John Smith,
thank you. I was thinking John Cook for some reason, but he was in Australia. You can see that his eyes are fairly small and his chin is huge. The opposite, right? It's maturity. It's showing virility, strength. Even in ones where they're not really even people, they're toys, we can see that the male cowboy has relatively small eyes compared to the female cowgirl, and then the chins, of course, are the opposite. Now, of course, he's kind of the geeky dweeb who eventually gets the girl because the girl really does see the nice guy underneath, but the one who's actually famous and strong and really popular has a huge chin and tiny eyes. And we can also compare the bodies. We can compare these hyper-masculine bodies with these filigree female bodies that are, even when the woman has somewhat of a strong role or an independent role, she's still very physically dainty and looks like she could probably snap with a little breeze. But the men, of course, are strong and virulent. So when we look at a typical toy aisle, they actually make the background of the boys' toys blue and the background of the girls' toys pink. And of course, all the toys are oriented toward either dependence for girls or toward action and virility for boys. They really enforce that. In fact, if you didn't know which aisle was the girls and which one was the boys, Walmart actually labels it. This sign up here has a picture of a girl that says girls, and this one has a picture of a boy that says boys. So in case you didn't figure it out, spelled out on the sign for you. Lilia actually asked me the other day, I took her shoe shopping, and she went for the pink aisle. She didn't like any of those shoes, so we went around to the black and blue aisle, and she picked out these Cars shoes. And she said, Mom, are these for boys? And I said, what do you think? She looked up and she goes, the sign says boys. So I think they're for whoever likes Cars. So she got them. But I mean, kids have these conscious processes in their heads where, is this okay for me to do? Is this not okay? And it's clearly spelled out, this is not okay for you if it's the wrong gender. A couple of ads here. Can you click on those? Legos, typical toy, you know, everyone had them. I don't know if it's going to give us audio. Yes, it will. Very slightly. Is that the audio? I think they saw it. It's okay. It just, you know, it shows boys are problem solvers, boys build things. It shows you know, them engaging in activities that are going to be useful to society. They're going to save the world, right? Very active. And here are the new sets of Legos called Lego Friends.
New Lego Friends. Welcome to beautiful Heart Lake City. I'm Stephanie. I'm going to a party at the new cafe with my friend Olivia.
That's me.
I just finished decorating my house. Time to chill with the girls.
At the beauty shop, Emma is styled and ready to go.
This is going to be so much fun. Here's the bet with Mia. See you soon.
The Newlyville Cafe is the coolest spot in Heart Lake City.
Welcome. I'm Andrea.
Cupcakes ready. I love being together with my friends.
Me too. Welcome to the world of Lego Friends. New Lego Friends. Each set sold separately. Not all characters included. Join us at LegoFriends.com. Ask your parents first.
They actually decided that the reason that Legos weren't selling to girls were because they weren't pink and pretty, and because the little Lego characters were very block figure-ish.
We've had the Lego experience. We went to the Mall of America before this whole situation. I said, why do I have to buy a multicultural set of 80 characters to get a female Lego? They said, you don't have no idea how many moms ask us that question.
Yep. And so to solve that problem, they came out with Lego Friends. Instead of being the actual block Legos, they're now actually people figures.
And that was clearly not what I had been asking for. It's clearly
right.
Not what any of the other moms were
right.
asking for. We had been asking for a regular Lego set that had mm-hmm. a female character.
Yep. And they gave them the big eyes, they gave them breasts, they gave them hair, because otherwise it's not attractive. Kids won't play with it. So I'll take you back a little ways here to 1950. Here's Cinderella, the one we all saw. I didn't see it in 1950. Is the volume working on there?
Oh.
about the story of Cinderella, of course. She was a poor girl with shabby clothes, but she's beautiful, right? She's got that natural beauty.
Of elongation in there.
Yes.
And that starts way back with the Petty Girls and Vargas and Varga girls mm-hmm. that were painted on World War II planes. And
right. Oh, good point. Yeah, so we have the distortion of the figures going way back. And of course, as long as you're beautiful, things will turn out okay. Right? She doesn't actually talk with the prince. He just sees her. Right? So as long as you're pretty, don't worry. It's going to work out all right for you. And you think, you know, this looks very old-fashioned. Kids today would say, oh, that's so out of date. Oh, yeah, it's completely, you know, it's a whole other world. We don't really think like that. And just the other day, my kids got a free My Little Pony DVD in the with one of their toys. And I put it in for them, so I figured My Little Pony is probably not violent. It's probably okay. And when we do see a violent show, Lilia goes, scary, Mommy, scary, turn it off. And at right after the point I'm going to show you here, I said, oh, my God, this is so scary. Let's turn it off. So compare that to this 2012 release of My Little Ponies. Just on the DVD part there. I have the time there for myself to remind me. She no longer needs her walker and is now perfectly healthy and can jump around. So being beautiful, of course, makes you healthy and young and vibrant and good. And then the other section I wanted to show you.
Are we talking about the Grand Galloping Gala?
7 minutes. Let's see here.
The extra ticket by doing the extra special destined to me.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
It's really long. And when I'm destined to meet him, I would stroll through the gala, and everyone would wonder, who is that mysterious man? They would never guess that I was just a simple pony from little old Ponyville. Why, I would cause such a sensation that I would be invited for an audience with Princess Celestia herself. And the princess would be so taken with the style and elegance that she would introduce me to him, her nephew, the most handsome, eligible unicorn stallion at Camelot. Our eyes would meet, our hearts would melt, our courtship would be magnificent. He would ask for my hook in marriage, and of course I would say, yes! We would have a royal wedding, but being a princess, we just... What I would become if I married him, the stallion of my dreams. Twilight, I simply cannot believe you would invite Piggy.
So that's how far we've come. Now, we have to contrast the fact that we want women to look younger and younger with the fact that we want them to take on older and older sexual roles at younger and younger ages. I found four pictures of Halloween costumes for butterflies. One is an infant, a toddler, a child, and a woman. And you can see the infant is the only one who actually resembles a butterfly in any way. The toddler has a black leather lace-up bustier. The child, which I think is ages 4 to 8, also has that bustier along with some leather lace-up strappy knee-high shoe things going on there. And of course, she actually has lingerie. She has, you know, fishnet nylons and what are those things called? Thank you, Gregorio. You know, with the low cuts and the, yes. Clearly butterfly. It's lingerie with wings, which I thought only Victoria's Secret was supposed to do. Okay. So what impact is this really having? Does this really stick? Do these messages actually get through to kids? This, I have to credit Jenna Trenega with this. She let me know that these pie charts existed. Highlights Magazine does a State of the Kid address every year, and they survey all their readers, and they have them fill out these things, different topics every year. And this past year, 2011, one of their topics was gender. And they asked boys and girls, what are girls better at than boys? The largest one you can see here is hair, makeup, and fashion. So it's all about beauty. The next biggest one is gymnastics and cheerleading. So sport, but still fairly feminine sport. The next biggest was actually sports and athletics. So we can see that some, you know, that active role is certainly more prevalent among girls today than in the past. Being smart was the next biggest. So another good advancement. But most of them are very stereotypically feminine. We have dancing, being nice, having good manners, art, sewing, and creativity, cooking and cleaning, music and singing, listening and paying attention, having and caring for babies, shopping, jumping rope, hula hoops, and skipping, being pretty, playing dolls, handwriting, fair enough, talking and gossiping, and hygiene. So of course, you know, it's still very stereotypically feminine.
Yeah. How long has this been going on?
This survey?
Yes.
They've been doing it, I think, for the last 6 years.
And it changes.
And the topics change every year. Mm-hmm. I think last year they did gender and bullying. Now here's the chart for boys. Now you can see that girls still have to be pretty girly, but there's at least a lot of ways to be girly. Boys, however, have only one way to be boyish, and that is to play sports. We refer to this as hegemonic masculinity. It's the idea that girls have a lot more latitude. So we're not just talking about this being restrictive for girls, it's actually probably more restrictive for boys. It's just that girls have more options that are all fairly undervalued in society. But it's mainly sports. We've got also in here video games, building and fixing things, fighting and being mean, contrast that with being nice and courteous for girls, being smart, shooting guns and hunting, getting dirty, contrast that with hygiene for the girls, riding bikes and motorized equipment, being annoying, getting along, so there's a little positive for the boys there. Being brave, and I love this one, using the bathroom. So we can see that beauty becomes a really important part of female socialization. Those Lego toys, there are six of them, and they include a beauty shop, a cafe where you hang out with your friends. One is an heiress, and her little set that she comes with is a hot tub. She comes with a little margarita and a little umbrella. Her job is to look pretty and hang out. It does come with a veterinarian, so not quite a doctor. Right? It has to be kind of a little bit, it can't quite be a full doctor. It's got to be something that's a little bit softer and a little bit okay for girls. And it does have an inventor, so that the inventor is the one that's not completely stereotyped as feminine. Also, girl Lego sets don't require actual building. Just so you know, they come pre-assembled.
What?
Yeah, girls don't have to build. Yes. So we have to ask, and if we have time, I'll get to this one couple's approach video clip. But we can see that this is clearly affecting young people's views of self. And when you ask people, so why do you wash the dishes in your marriage? Why do you do the laundry in your marriage? If it happens to be the woman who does it, she'll often say, because I prefer to do it. I actually don't mind it. I like it. I like it more than other things that I might do. Oftentimes, that's not the case, but when it is gender tight, people will usually say that they prefer those roles. Right? So they'll say, no one told me. You know, no one told me to do it. He didn't make me do it. I prefer it. But the question is, why? Why do women tend to prefer female type things? Why do women want to prefer to try to make themselves look better every day? And why do men not prefer those things as much as women? And it really comes down to this socialization that's a huge part of our lives from such a young age. What Bourdieu referred to as the habitus, it's an imprint on our minds that it pre-exists any other knowledge we have. All other knowledge we have operates within this framework that's imprinted on our minds from basically birth.
Yeah, but I had an experience, because I really truly wantedmy children not to be gendered. Mm-hmm. And actually, they're both lawyers, so I don't know. It worked. Anyway, but I had this Lego set, and they were both playing with the Legos, and I was just patting myself on the back for being such a good mother that my kids were playing with the Legos, and they were both doing it, and it was just fine, and they were just little at the time. And so then my daughter brought her things that she made in, and I said, well, what did you make? And she said, well, this is the mommy car, this is the daddy car, and this is the baby car. And I'm like, oh. Of course, my son had not made a mommy, daddy, and baby car. But it just made me realize that there really are, I think, true differences that mm-hmm. That aren't bad, mm-hmm. but they're different.
Right, so some people argue that certainly there's biological bases for all of these tendencies. Right, if we look back to a pre-market economy, if we look back to agricultural economies or simple trade economies, there still were gender-typed roles. Right? Although, I will point out that 80% of calories consumed by hunter-gatherer tribes were gathered by women, so they were the breadwinners. But basically, just based on that physical strength, we did have differences. We can trace that all the way back. But what we need to look at is how those basic differences become such huge and exaggerated differences in society, and not for all families. And I think it's wonderful that you gave that experience to them. I think that's the goal of many people. But of course, sometimes Cinderella eats your daughter when you're not looking, which is eventually those peers become more important agents of socialization, and then what do you do? So I wanted to open it up. What are some things that we can do in everyday lives? You know, something like making sure that all the different types of toys are available to kids in the home. It's a great one. What about maybe teenagers, too? Think of them as well.
Well, one of the other things that I observed in our neighborhood, we had like a group of boys and a group of girls. It was kind of ideal. And all the girls would meet in our basement. And they had made it into a town. So there was a school and a store, and they would play these games, and they would be like the store proprietor or the teacher or the students or whatever. And I happened to go over to the house where the boys were playing, and they were doing the same thing in a garage, except for they were like above, and they're like, this guy did that and that. They were observing the world from a different perspective. They weren't inside of it. Mm-hmm. That was very, I'm obviously a sociology major. But it just fascinated me that they were essentially doing the same thing, but from a completely different perspective on the world. Maybe they were 10, 8, 7, 8, 9, 10, some age like that.
Wow. So they kind of managed and directed the activities of the city rather than actually engaging in them.
Yeah, instead of being inside of it, they were making this guy go over here and that guy go there, and he was in a plane and he was in a car and stuff, and they were doing the same thing. It's just interesting.
Gary.
I think a key component is you pointed out the sort of relentless marketing. And I think that one of the things that's happened to childhood is that it's become completely enthralled to this relentless marketing. And I think one of the best things you can do is just not participate in watching children's television and instead, choose stuff that's a little more thoughtful, and not assume that you can put it on automatic pilot, because that's where they get a lot of it. I mean, the commercials and the ridiculous products that they're. I mean, I was very interested in this Lego thing because Pippa and Dot used to play Legos,
We had a set with aliens. They weren't even humans.
Yeah.
So.
These little space stations.
Yeah.
So you could make the aliens female or male.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm pretty sure we had one of each. So we kind of designed
both.
Yeah. I mean, they could have been.
That's right.
Yeah.
But at what? But at what point are they forced into this hyper-gender world by essentially the devious designs of people who are trying to. It's the same thing as you get for I talk a lot to my students about youth culture, which didn't exist before the 1950s, mm-hmm. and say basically this is a marketing niche. Mm-hmm. Hey, you're actually supposed to be adults now, you know? So why are you still kids? But I, for me, that's a big part of it, is trying to find other ways to, which is hard because mm-hmm. they go to other children's houses and are bombarded.
Right, when we think about those agents of socialization, we can say where are the negative messages coming from most of all? You might say media.
Yeah.
So maybe actively preventing certain types of socialization would be good.
Well, I remember when the kids were little, Bob and I took this critical TV watching curriculum. I think the PTA or somebody put it out, I can't remember. But we took that to heart, and we like our TV at our house. It's our, you know, one of the vices that we have, we quit smoking, you know, but we still like our TV. But we do watch it critically, and we watch it with them, and when they show different things, whether it's, you know, how women are treated gender-wise, or even like when they were littler, the toy commercials. Now, you realize, I mean, it was heartbreaking when they realized that that RoboCop did not, the toy, I remember this so distinctly. For one, it fell apart in like the first day that he opened the package, but it did not do anything that RoboCop did in the movie. You know, and it was, you know, that was like a crisis and a realization that you know, things aren't like on TV. But we go back to that again and again. Remember, this is not real life, and in real life, this happens. And this is just TV. This is just entertainment. Mm-hmm. This is just, you know, this isn't the way things should be. And do you know people who act this way in the real world? Is that how you want to act? I would hope not. And, you know, do a lot of critical viewing with them.
There are some great photos on Sociological Images. It's a website where it takes ads for clothing and perfume and other things like that. And they look at what scene has been set up in the ad, and then they go and reenact it in real life. So there's one where this woman is laying in this really weird position in the flowers, and they had someone go into a garden in New York City and actually lay in the flowers like that, and they filmed it, how people would react. And it just it takes it out of that context. It makes it so odd. And you just realize how crazy these ads really are.
That's awesome. I've seen that.
Yeah, Monica?
It's kind of apt that we're having this conversation right now because my parents are visiting and they have very distinct gender roles, and my dad was outside, and a couple of my sisters, we have sort of a large sample size because we have 8 kids in our family. Two of my sisters have really embraced the gender roles, and my other sister and I have rallied against it. It's daddy's iron and mommy's drill. And I'm the one, and she's the one. When something is broken in the house, we fix it. And I'm sorry, Eric, the daddies don't. I feel as though we somehow, for whatever reason, saw that as an injustice, and we wanted to not have that. And to this day, I get physically angry when I have to do dishes. I'm serious. So it was kind of cinched the deal when Eric came over to my apartment and did dishes. He was the one for me.
So actively modeling these roles, not only maybe for your own children, but children in the community, young people, teenagers in the community, actively modeling roles that are empowering to women and show that men can do quote unquote feminine tasks just as well.
In the garage, so.
Yeah. I mean, like, I would love to be that awesome feminist person who can like fix stuff. I'm not that great with tools, but you know, my mom has her own toolbox, and she, you know, rode horses and would go backpacking with all her dude friends and stuff in her youth. But she also cooks and sews, and you know, she made us 90s when we were little. But my dad is like the sensitive poet guy, but he can also fix the roof. So there's a lot of equality in the gender thing, and I guess it's less about just defying all the stereotypes and doing the opposite, and more just doing what you feel is good or right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's my take on it.
Yeah, so flexibility in those roles. You have to cross over either way.
Yeah.
That's you were talking about Cinderella Ate My Daughter, and that was one of her huge points, is that as a society, we talk about these gender roles, and we assume that the person that does the dishes is the weak person. And maybe we need to talk about the person doing the dishes as being the person that's filling the role, and it's not lesser or more.
Right, so unpaid doesn't mean invaluable.
I just told him, maybe the next generation can get to that point, but right now I'm just reacting.
Yeah. No, I didn't mean it as a...
No, but it is. Yeah. It would be more enlightened to get to that point, but right now I just get physically sick.
I was just that Lego Friends commercial I saw in a completely different way. My household is very challenged with communication from the male half, not a problem for me. And so it was interesting that the girls, what was deemed important by that commercial was socializing. Mm-hmm. And I think as a society, we do have, men have a harder time communicating or just being with friends and talking through things where women typically don't. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, that's what I saw in it.
Right, boys' toys are not really about relating to other people, and girls' toys almost always are.
Well, just like how it started, the two girls together making a heart.
Right.
It's not like the boys came out before they were building helicopters to save the world, gave each other a hug, you know?
But men have very strong friendships. I mean, they do. Mm-hmm. It's just different. I mean, they can't expect them to be like us.
But men tend to have a few much closer friends, whereas girls tend to have one or two very close friends and then a wider circle of friends beyond that. So there are definitely differences in that too. Dick, last comment?
Is there time? Okay, it won't be real long. I know in treatment for alcohol and drug problems, there is a growing awareness that men have special needs. There were special needs for minorities, special needs recognized for women, and now especially for men. And my sense is, there are obviously biological differences, not just sexually, well, I mean in terms of, you know, but in the brain, that I think there's a lot of research shows that, that women, both hemispheres of the brain are much more active in women than men. Women use about 3 times as many words a day than men. Now, some of this may be due to socialization. Some of it is, I think, biological. So it's probably more the way in which the biological differences have been exaggerated. And that, so if you use more words, you're communicating more. Women tend to be more cooperative, to connect more. Men have been socialized also to be more independent and to be more cut off. Mm-hmm. And if you're connecting with people more, you're probably more in touch with your feelings, you know, pleasant and unpleasant ones. And if you're more isolated, one is more restricted with feelings. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that men have a lot of problems with is both experiencing feelings, knowing how to deal with them other than through anger, violence, or depression. And the stereotype has been women have feelings, men don't. And therefore, and boys learn this very early. You know, if you're crying, you know, be like a man, or, you know, there's always a put down, or not always, but frequently. And so a big distinction that I found helpful was feelings are not feminine, feelings are human. We all have feelings, we all have a right to them. And why are men deprived of this very important part of who they are?
Mm-hmm. Right, it's certainly even more restrictive of men than of women in many cases.
Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks.
All right, we are now going to sing hymn 212, just the first 3 verses. Mm-hmm.